everyone. I'm Major Garrett in Washington. Welcome to The Takeout. Is it a bluff teetering on a budgetary cliff? President Trump said today the U.S. has no interest in diplomacy with Iran, even as he said regime leaders are desperate, his word, to cut a deal. Trump said the U.S. is not leaving and intends to inflict still more aerial damage on a vast array of Iranian targets. One he mentioned after being questioned about it is called Pickaxe Mountain. But this war will soon run into genuine budget limits, and we'll have more on those limits in just a moment. So, what is Pickaxe Mountain? Recent reporting from the Wall Street Journal, based on Israeli intelligence summaries, warns that Iran last fall moved thousands of centrifuges inside Pickaxe Mountain, possibly to reconstitute its nuclear program, and did so after U.S. and Israeli bombing runs struck its three main facilities last summer. Quick science lesson. Centrifuges spin uranium gas in a process that separates isotopes in order to create enriched uranium. That product can be used for civilian energy or, when more highly enriched, a nuclear weapon. Iran, after telling the world for years and years and years it has no interest in nuclear weapons, we should remind ourselves, has produced more than 900 pounds of near-weapons-grade enriched uranium. Back to Pickaxe Mountain. It is believed to have room for centrifuges at least 300 feet and possibly 450 feet beneath its solid rock exterior. In the Oval Office today, sitting alongside the president of Lebanon, President Trump appeared to concede Pickaxe was now relevant to U.S. targeting.
You're talking about the centrifuges? Yeah, it doesn't mean anything unless they have the material. They don't have. We follow the material. That's where the action is. And we'll be hitting that area very, probably pretty soon. And there's not a thing they can do about it.
While the U.S. controls the skies above Iran militarily, Congress controls the Pentagon budget, and the Iran war is taking a noticeable toll. The Washington Post today reported critical sources of military funding are due to expire in weeks. As a result, the military has already scaled back training and maintenance to extend available warfighting funds. Trump has asked Congress for $67 billion to cover Iran war costs. The fate of that request is uncertain. During testimony on behalf of that emergency war funding, protesters interrupted Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth.
$1.5 trillion.
Mr. Secretary, please.
Later in his testimony, Hegseth told the Senate Appropriations Committee that the war thus far has cost $37.5 billion. Here's why all this matters. This is the last week the House and Senate will be in session simultaneously until September 14th. Neither body has approved the emergency Pentagon funding. The House may move a bill tomorrow, which would put the Senate in position to act. Also, we should note, the dignified transfer, the most recent American service members killed in the war, will not happen today, as the White House had originally said. President Trump and other senior officials will attend that transfer at Dover Air Force Base when it occurs. Two Americans were killed over the weekend in Jordan by an Iranian missile, and today, Trump appeared to suggest Jordanian forces were somehow to blame.
They're being degraded really so seriously. They did slip something through in Jordan, and if we had other operators, you know, would not have happened, unfortunately. But because we have the best equipment in the world, you know, we've stopped almost everything.
We begin tonight with CBS News senior national security correspondent Charlie Daggett, who joins us from Amman, Jordan. That last remark, Charlie, I hope you heard it from the president, holding out that there might have been something that the Jordanians did wrong.
Yeah, you know, we've been trying to follow up that story with the loss of two U.S. Soldiers here, another one still missing in action at an airbase here in Jordan. And we spoke to analysts who tell us that when you look at the kind of robust fortifications and anti-missile defenses that you would have in places like Kuwait, established U.S. bases, and in Bahrain, which is the headquarters of the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet. What they have here in Jordan isn't anywhere near that amount of air defenses. So when President Trump is possibly suggesting that it wasn't U.S. air defenses, but perhaps Jordanian air defenses that let down those missiles that were coming in, that is a criticism for this country. But we're not looking at the same scale of air defenses. We're talking about Patriot missile defense systems, not anything like what you might see in Kuwait and Bahrain. And I think that's our starting point where we see U.S. forces here, because honestly, the Jordanians haven't even mentioned that the U.S. military had permanent bases here. So that's the kind of regional sensitivities that they're dealing with here. And they don't. I mean, Jordan isn't Kuwait. Jordan isn't Bahrain. Jordan isn't the UAE. They don't have that kind of robust air defense systems. I mean, if you want to compare it to Israel, as a matter of fact, it's nowhere near that kind of air defense systems. But if there are U.S. troops in any location, there are U.S. air defenses in order to protect those troops.
And obviously, the Iranians know about this and perceive it to be a softer underbelly of U.S. exposure in the region.
Well, exactly that. You know, right about now, we'd normally be talking about a new wave of U.S. airstrikes. It's happened for the past 10 nights. Tonight would be 11 nights in a row. It doesn't mean it's not going to happen. It just means it hasn't happened yet. So, yes, in terms of that Iranian retaliation, they have struck Bahrain. They struck Kuwait once again. But they've also widened that scope to include Jordan, including those strikes that killed two U.S. soldiers. And I have to mention here, that wasn't just one strike on that airbase. It was two strikes in 48 hours. And not just when I say strikes, that doesn't mean missiles. Several missiles were fired, precision missiles that were able to attack that base. So, yes, the Jordanians may not make a noise about U.S. forces here, but the Iranians know exactly where U.S. forces are positioned.
From Aman Jordan tonight with our thanks, Charlie Daggett. I appreciate it very much. Let's bring in our Weijia Jiang from the White House. Weijia, the president had a lot to say today about the Iran war, and some of it was, we're going to continue. This goes on, this goes on, this goes on.
That's right, Major. President Trump says that they are just getting started, and he sent the message that if Iran does not behave in the way that he wants to, there is a lot more severe consequences to have to pay. You see him right there. He was hosting the president of Lebanon, who was really lobbying for President Trump to apply more pressure to Israel and its prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to withdraw troops from southern Lebanon. But Major, in terms of Iran, he had this to say when it came to what more could be in store.
If we left today, it would take them decades to rebuild. And I don't believe they could ever rebuild. And honestly, they haven't seen anything yet. We've been nice. We've been nice.
But Major, it's not just the U.S. that has been launching strikes. For 10 straight days now, it has been quite the back and forth. And Iran doesn't appear to show any signs of stopping. Today, the president also said that even though that's true, Iran wants to end this very badly. He said, you don't know what they're saying behind the scenes, and that they are desperate for the fighting to stop, Major.
How should we understand the visit of the Lebanese president and what the administration is trying to accomplish there to defuse some of the hostility from Iran that occurs there via Hezbollah?
Well, Lebanon and Israel entered a framework of an agreement last month that is supported by the U.S. In fact, the U.S. helped to broker it, and now they want to help implement it. The problem, Major, is that whether Israel leaves Lebanon hinges on the disarmament of Iranian-backed Hezbollah. And Hezbollah has been very vocal to say that is simply not going to happen. And so that is a very difficult situation. And the president said today to President Aoun of Lebanon that he would be willing to personally speak with Hezbollah and try to engage them in this framework. So even though Israel is withdrawing some troops, the fact of the matter is, with that missing piece of the militant group that they're trying to break apart, not being part of these conversations and the framework, Israel has said their security forces are not going anywhere. But certainly the president will continue this fight to apply pressure. He obviously wants to be able to say that he helped with, you know, the end of that conflict, Major.
Long history of the Lebanese military being unable to dislodge Hezbollah from southern Lebanon. Weijia Jiang, North Lawn of the White House, thanks so much. Matthew Kronick joins me now. He's a non-resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. He served in the Department of Defense and Intelligence Community during the George W. Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations. He's well read in on this, ladies and gentlemen. Matthew, great to see you as always. Thanks so much.
Great to be back.
A broad question. Where are we with this? How do you assess what you've heard the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, well, I think it's good to remind people why this started. Iran's had this illegal nuclear program that the United States wanted to degrade and prevent Iran from building nuclear weapons. And then we're also concerned that Iran was essentially following the North Korea strategy of building up a conventional deterrent that would make it impossible for a country to intervene in the future.
Once it had something.
Once it had, I think the plan was to build up that conventional capability, rebuild the nuclear program, and then threaten to hold the region at risk with conventional power. And so that was why we needed to degrade the conventional military power starting in February. But where are we now? I think President Trump and the United States really would like a negotiated settlement to this, but the Iranians are dug in. And the key sticking point is the Strait of Hormuz. They're insisting they control the Strait of Hormuz and international waterway. That's obviously unacceptable to the United States. And so the only real options now are to give up, which is unacceptable, or to escalate. And I think we see the president escalating.
From your vantage point, was the asymmetric use of the Strait of Hormuz by Iran as a point of leverage predictable?
Yes and no. Yes, when I worked on the Iran desk at the Pentagon 15 years ago, we worried about Iran closing the Strait of Hormuz. But really, the scenarios we thought about were using mines to essentially close the Strait of Hormuz to everyone. The way Iran is using drones and new technology is essentially to threaten its enemies, but to allow friendly shipping to come through, I think, was creative. And that's really the problem. It's not that Iran is physically controlling the strait. As long as it has drones and is threatening to target enemy shipping, insurers in London and commercial shipping companies aren't willing to send ships through.
Two questions. When the American public hears the president say it would take them decades to rebuild, and I don't even think they could rebuild. He's talking about their nuclear ambitions. Most Americans would say, well, then let's leave. Why not? I mean, if it's decades, we've more or less solved the problem for the foreseeable future. What are we hanging around for? Yeah.
Well, that is the most important threat that Iran posed. And I think the president's right that their nuclear program has been significantly degraded. It will take them time to rebuild. The main problem now is Iran, again, is asserting control over the Strait of Hormuz. It's an international waterway. Something like 30% of the world's oil used to flow through there. And so imagine the precedent that sets. Does China say countries can't go through the South China Sea or we're going to tax them? Or Malaysia or Singapore say they can't go through the Malacca Straits? So there are bigger principles of international law. And it matters to the average American because it matters to their pocketbook. And
no doubt. And when you hear me describe, based on the Wall Street Journal reporting and other reporting, this place called Pickaxe Mountain and Israeli intelligence summary saying maybe centrifuges are moving in there, it's hardened, it's way below ground. President says, well, all you care about is the highly enriched uranium. Fact check, true. But what should we make of all this? And why haven't those places, Matthew, been on the perpetual target list since this all got started February 28th?
Yes. Well, the main facilities for Iran's nuclear program going back more than a decade were these four key facilities that were destroyed last summer. Midnight Hammer. And so I think Pickaxe Mountain was something of a backup plan. And so it was a hole essentially in the side of a mountain. And it wasn't until last fall after the Midnight Hammer strikes that Iran started moving the nuclear equipment, the centrifuges, into that facility. And so suddenly now it's a facility of interest. And so I do think it makes sense for the United States to put that on the target list as we resume bombing. And you're right, it is a hard and deepened facility. But people said the four facilities that were hit last summer were also hardened and deepened, but they weren't so hard and deep that they could get out of the reach of the U.S. military.
Matthew Kroenig, I appreciate your time as always. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Turning to Capitol Hill, lawmakers, lots of questions for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dan Kane, over the cost and the prosecution of the war with Iran. Our Caitlin Huey-Burns joins us now from Capitol Hill. Caitlin, what do we hear?
Hey, Major. Well, this was an Appropriations Committee hearing, so that means that these lawmakers want to know about all this money that the Pentagon is asking for, nearly $90 billion they're asking for in supplemental funds. How's it going to be spent, and why are you asking for more money when you said that this war would just be about 4 to 6 weeks? Now, the big headline coming out of this is that so far this war has cost $37.5 billion to date. That's what Hegseth told lawmakers. The Pentagon is asking for more funds. They've already spent close to or are prepared to have spent the money that was allocated in that one big beautiful bill, an increase in Pentagon funds. And Hegseth's case was that the munition stockpile has been diminished, so they need to replenish it. They also need to be able to train members of the military and be prepared for what is to come. But Major, it was notable because, you know, up here talking to lawmakers from both sides of the aisle, they acknowledge that they want this wrapped up quickly. Republicans acknowledge that as well. I mean, they are on the ballot in the midterm election where the economy, questions about the war, questions about gas prices are going to hit them directly. But you couldn't really tell that Republicans had any sort of anxiety about how this is going on. They were very deferential to Hegseth, except for one. I should note, Senator Kennedy of Louisiana pressed the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense on what we're doing here. Take a listen.
Sure, that's General, putting economic pressure on
them. I'm not asking you for, I'm not trying to get you in trouble. I know your advice to the president is private, but this is serious as four heart attacks and a stroke. Now, what happens if we come home and end the blockade to the world?
Sir, Iran has the potential to continue to be a threat, and we will need to prepare military
will
options
to do that. Will they toll the strait?
Sir, that's a hypothetical question, and I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, it's not hypothetical. We come home. It's not going to be hypothetical. You know that, General.
So that stood out to me, Major, because he was really the lone Republican pressing on this, even though there are these general anxieties about this very issue. Even if you withdraw, what does that mean for the Strait? So those questions persist. This hearing is still ongoing as we speak. But notably, this is a Congress tasked with whether to give more money to the Pentagon with all of this going on. And a lot of questions also revolved around all of this money being spent. What does that take away from our ability to help and aid Ukraine in that ongoing effort? So there was kind of a subset of questions around that. But it was notable, Major, because there weren't really direct answers about how much longer this will go on, how much longer the Strait will continue to be the key issue here. So we'll see whether there is any sort of answers going on. But basically, what Hegseth kept referring to was trying to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon.
Caitlin Huey-Burns, Capitol Hill, thank you so very much. Still to come, he's an independent now, but a key swing vote still for the House GOP leadership. Kevin Kiley joins us to explain where he will and maybe where he won't help the House GOP majority. Also, what the FDA is saying about the infectious parasite that has sickened thousands of Americans. Produce giant Taylor Farms is still the focus. Talk about that. Plus, primary day in Arizona, notable races for governor on the GOP side and a House race of interest on the Democratic side. We will take a look from the famous Takeout Tavern. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds. Well, it's about to be finished. Welcome back to Take It. Look, I know it's a cliche to say it's crunch time for the House Republican majority. What week is it a crunch time for the House Republican majority? The margins are so narrow, lots of legislative items, but this week really is. Lots of bills that are pending. Kevin Kiley joins us now from Capitol Hill. Former Republican, he's an independent, but he still votes procedurally and otherwise with Republicans more often than not. Congressman, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. So the first item of business I want to ask you about, $67 billion request from the Pentagon to replenish depleted and soon to expire funding for this war. You in favor of that? Do you think it's going to pass in the House tomorrow?
Well, I've said that we need to fund our troops, of course, but this is not the way to do that. I've made it very clear that going down this path of budget reconciliation, which is by definition a strictly party line process, is not the way to provide additional funding in a way that will assert Congress's Article I authority and ultimately facilitate an end to this conflict on acceptable terms. So I'm very skeptical about the reconciliation process itself. The way this has been set forward is not designed to have the sort of intense congressional involvement and scrutiny and oversight that I think is needed at this point. So I'm disappointed that this is how it's played out.
You going to vote no?
I'm very unlikely to support it. You know, I'm always open to arguments on either side and to new evidence as it comes forward. But at this point, based upon what I said from the outset, it's very unlikely this is something I'll support.
Because to your point, Congressman, if you use reconciliation and the legislative language arrives pretty late in the process, as it has, it's essentially a jam job for everyone in the body, up or down, and you don't have a lot of oversight or scrutiny of the underlying budget or reasons behind it. That's why you're angry.
That's right. And even beyond that, this is really Congress's opportunity to be involved in ending this conflict to the extent that we should have been involved since its beginning. Because that is the power of Congress. That's our most important power. Is the power of the purse. And so, yes, the administration is coming to Congress saying that we need funding. And so Congress can say, okay, we will provide funding for X, Y, and Z, but not for A, B, and C. Or we're going to provide funding with this limitation. Or we're going to provide funding, for example, for the sort of negotiations and outreach to the Gulf states and other allies that I think we need in order to make any agreement and peace here more durable. The fact that Congress is missing that opportunity, I think, is very unfortunate.
So let's dig into this a bit deeper. If you're a no, Thomas Massie is a no. That might mean other Republicans are a no. And if this thing goes down, there's no Senate vehicle to take up. The House is due to leave town later this week and not return until late in August. This could go unresolved for all of the remainder of this break. Is that right?
Well, what should happen is we should then have a bipartisan product, because I absolutely think we need to assure that we replenish the stockpiles that have been depleted. And I know that folks on both sides of the aisle think that, believe that. But, you know, we need to come up with a number that makes sense and uses of those funds that make sense, because Americans don't want this thing to keep dragging on and on and on. I think Americans are tired of the whiplash and this high wire act. This ad hoc, we're having an agreement this day, but then we're back to bombing the next day. I think people understand that, you know, it's very difficult to reach a resolution where you're dealing with a regime like the Iranians. But we can't have this continue to drag on indefinitely. And I think that the way that we make progress towards bringing it to an end, while assuring we get the Strait of Hormuz open and we assure Iran never gets a nuclear weapon, is to have Congress involved in a bipartisan way.
But you know the White House wants this reconciliation vehicle because it also wants the so-called SAVE Act. It wants all of those things and is basically defying members of Congress like you to say no and take the wrath of the White House and possibly the MAGA base. I know that's less important to you than it used to be.
Well, this is something that I have an issue with as well. I think when we're dealing with funding our troops, vital national security objectives, it shouldn't be tossed in with some other unrelated legislation. We should be considering this on its own terms. What sort of funding at this moment will protect our troops, will give us the best opportunity to wind this conflict down while achieving the important objectives of opening the strait and ensuring Iran doesn't get nuclear weapons? Bringing in extraneous legislation, I don't think advances that goal at all.
So before I let you go, do you think all this, carefully crafted by the House Republican leadership and the Speaker Mike Johnson, is going to come and collapse on the floor tomorrow and Thursday?
You know, Major, I don't know that I want to be in the prediction business. The House has surprised in ways both good and bad many times so far this year. But I will say it is unfortunate that we're having so much that is coming to a head in 1 week. I mean, we had many prior weeks where the House was sent home early because of dysfunction. We had the longest government shutdown in U.S. history where the House wasn't here for seven consecutive weeks. So I don't really think this is a good model for how the legislative process should work. But that being said, we do have a number of important items that are up this this week. So I hope that the House can rise to the occasion and legislate in the interest of the American people.
If it doesn't, it'll be dysfunction with a capital D. Congressman Kevin Kiley, independent of California, I appreciate the time. Thank you. Coming up, former President Biden is trying and not succeeding at his attempts to block the release of tapes his biographer recorded more than a decade ago. You remember that story? Where that legal battle stands. When we come back, you're watching and, as always, enjoying The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Welcome to the Conversation Corner. Here is a look at what else we and now you are watching this evening. Federal appeals court has blocked former President Biden's effort to stop the Justice Department from giving a conservative think tank access to redacted transcripts and audio recordings that he carried out with his biographer. These documents and recordings date back a decade ago, 2016 to 2017. That's around the same time Special Counsel Robert Hur, I know you remember this, looked in to Biden's handling of government documents, sensitive ones, while he was serving as vice president. Biden was not charged with any crime stemming from that investigation. The court's opinion has been stayed, meaning more legal drama to come until August 3rd to allow for, you guessed it, more appeals. A powerful storm system is causing and has caused significant disruptions at airports across the Northeast. Today alone, more than 1,600 flights were canceled, nearly 4,000 delayed. Since Saturday, roughly 4,000 flights have been canceled. And yes, it's not really important, but those of us here on The Takeout are much aware of these problems. Airports in New York City, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and Atlanta, and Boston have been hardest hit. We here at The Takeout have felt it. The southern United States are bracing, by the way, for bad weather of its own. Tropical Storm Bertha is bringing heavy rains and 50-mile-per-hour winds west of Florida. Over the next few days, Bertha is expected to move across the Gulf, through New Orleans, and on to Houston. We'll keep an eye on this and bring you updates as required. Today, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said the outbreak of a severe intestinal illness is under control. And he said the source has been identified. The FDA still believes Taylor Farms is the source of the contaminated lettuce, despite a sample that it said inaccurately tested positive, creating lots of consumer confusion. Last week, that company, Taylor Farms, voluntarily recalled iceberg lettuce from a farm in central Mexico. The CDC says more than 1,600 people have been sickened, but that number could be much closer to 7,000 because CDC data often, as we have learned, lags behind reporting from state health departments. Former FDA Commissioner Dr. Robert Califf joins me now. Doctor, it's great to have you here. Big question. How do you assess the federal response thus far?
Well, I know the people at FDA have been working really hard, and I do think, you know, the epidemiologic evidence that they've gathered really points in the direction that I think you reported quite accurately, the Taylor Farms, if you look at all that they've said. I do worry, though, that, you know, the FDA is depleted, so is the Agriculture Department, so is the CDC. And, you know, it makes you worry that the response could always be more forceful and not impeding other work that needs to get done. When something like this happens, you end up with all hands on deck, and then you wonder what else is not getting done across the agency. But basically, I think they've done their job. And of course, we always look for ways to make it better.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said, you know, all the cuts that we made, they were just for redundancies. They haven't affected anything on testing or surveillance or monitoring. Should the American public be willing to accept that explanation?
No. To be blunt, no. I mean, that's just not true. So I'm sure that over time, the full effect of DOGE will be analyzed by many people. But I think within HHS and FDA, of course, I left. I was a Obama and then a Biden appointee. And so I was not there when the cuts were made. But I sure know a lot of people with a lot of talent who were cut with no real assessment of what their jobs were or what needed to be done. You know, there's a big example people are talking about today. There was a joint committee between FDA and Agriculture Department that focused on the science of infections in agriculture, exactly what this problem is. And it was disbanded for no apparent reason. And they were in the middle of a lot of important work that would have informed how to proceed forward. So, no, I don't think that's a accurate assessment, and we'll see when the dust settles.
Doctor, I've read that symptoms can arrive in 2 days or as many as 12 days. So it's somewhat hard to get people to remember what they consumed, where they consumed, if it was 2 weeks ago.
That's right. And this is the problem with this particular parasite, which is a parasite. It gets into the intestine, it sort of roots in there and takes up habitat, and it takes a few days or even as long as 2 or 3 weeks. And so in terms of pinpointing where the source was, that's a difficulty, but it's also a difficulty knowing when you're out of danger. When is it that this is over? Because people who got in, let's say, ate some lettuce 2 days ago, they wouldn't get sick probably for another couple of weeks. So we've still got a ways to go here to get this sorted out. Should also point out, and this was noted in the FDA communications, every summer there's some cyclospora. I mean, this isn't a parasite that's abundant in nature. And so we have these small outbreaks every year, not a big one like this. This is quite unusual. But there are probably some other small outbreaks that are going on simultaneously, like would happen every summer. So we've got to keep that in mind, too, as we look at the numbers.
Dr. Robert Califf, former FDA commissioner, I appreciate your time and expertise very much. Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Coming up next, two Republican congressmen seek the nomination for Arizona governor. We'll break down those primaries and look ahead, of course, to November. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Welcome to The Takeout Tavern. Remember, kids, I always have coffee. I show it to you every time just so we know what's going on. Torian Small joins us. He's going to talk to us about the Arizona primaries going on today. One quick note, Department of Justice just released a statement saying it will send monitors from the Civil Rights Division to three counties in Arizona tonight, Maricopa, Apache, and Pima. Talk about the races going on in Arizona, Torian.
Yeah, I mean, just on that, I think it's quite striking. And the idea behind it, according to the government, is that they just want to ensure transparency. That certainly would inspire confidence among Democrats who have claimed that the president is trying to tip the scales and potentially, you know, intimidate voters from coming to the polls. As it relates to some of the races we're watching, we've got to start at the top, right?
Right.
The governor's race, Katie Hobbs. She, you know, defeated Carrie Lake in that race and made a case for this centrist moderate Democrat. She's now potentially facing Andy Biggs, who was a former House Freedom Caucus chair, current congressman, and also another congressman in David Schweikert.
Yeah. Andy Biggs has the president's endorsement.
Yes, which is a major thing for him. I think the case that she could make come November is that this is a rehash of a previous race. This is far right figure versus a centrist Democrat.
Andy Biggs is another Carrie Lake.
Exactly.
Andy Biggs, though, is trying to talk more recently that he knows how to get things done. He can work in a bipartisan way, which is an odd maneuver for someone so deeply rooted in the MAGA world.
Certainly. He's trying to make the appeal broader, right? So he can't just have Republicans get him across the finish line, even though some data shows that, you know, Republicans are outpacing when it comes to registration. Whether or not that will affect turnout on an all-presidential year.
Trump won Arizona big in 2024. Oh, what about House races on the Democratic side?
Yeah, CD1, Schweikert jumping out of his respective race now creates a toss-up situation in a pretty competitive district. He won narrowly last cycle, and one of his opponents from that cycle, or his opponent from that cycle, Amish Shah, is running again. I think what's notable here is that the DCCC isn't backing him, even though he came really close that time around. Their Red to Blue program endorsed Marlene Galeon Woods, who came in third place in the primary last time around. Shah has come out and said, this is another example of Washington meddling in these
and kind of an
races.
Establishment, non-establishment fracture within the House Democratic primary race.
Exactly. The DCCC is saying that they're looking at broader appeal, right? Shah didn't win for a reason in their minds, and they think it will be no different this time around.
And obviously, turnout is a big factor tonight. And with this Department of Justice thing, we will see how it plays out. Does it create an atmosphere of belief and confidence, or one of intimidation and backing off? We'll find out when the results come in. Torian Small, thanks for joining me here at the Tavern. Great to have you. Coming up, the Republican Party has a lot more cash on hand than Democrats. I mean, a lot, a lot, a lot. We'll get into it when we come back, when we have our political panel next on The Takeout. Welcome back to Takeout. Yep, still at the Tavern. I love it. Political panel time. Democratic strategist Kurt Bardella, Republican strategist Aaron McGuire. They co-host, by the way, Party Lines podcast. Isn't that fun?
We do. We do.
We so, clearly don't spend enough time
already on
each other.
Party animals.
All right. Graphics department, bring these up. How much do the Republicans have overall for the midterms? Republicans, if you do not count the MAGA super PAC, 607.1 million cash on hand. Democrats, across all their various committees, 226.3. That's a huge difference. Oh, wait a minute. Let's add in the MAGA super PAC. That's another 400 million. Look at those numbers. 1.05 billion to 226.3. Kurt? What do you think of that?
The one thing I want to point out, and these are about like the DCCC, the NRCC, but when you look at who's gotten the most money campaign-wise, actual individual campaigns, Democrats are outperforming Republicans in the top 25 contested seats.
So the candidates raise themselves for their own campaigns.
That's right. And the grassroots movements on those campaigns are actually outperforming by far what the national parties are doing, which frankly isn't surprising to me when you look at the Democratic Party brand. Let's just be honest real quick. The organizing Democratic Party brand is not popular with the Democratic Party base. After what we saw with the 2024 election, the idea that Democrats, donors would be
going to funnel a bunch of money into that
decision-making apparatus. They're going to send it to the districts and the candidates they support.
Aaron, fair point?
I think that is a fair point. And I think the counter to that is the question for Republicans. That is $1 billion roughly sitting in outside entities. How are they going to spend? What are they going to spend? There was reporting today that the White House political team, the senior team, James Blair, Susie Wiles, Tony Fabrizio, the pollster, all got together today to have another conversation about messaging and about midterms and how they plan to spend that money. Because Trump's very good at raising money. He's been the best that Republicans have ever seen. The question for Republicans is always, great, you've got it. How are you going to spend
it? And when are you going to spend it?
Because right now—
In the second quarter, they spent nothing for any—
Campaigns are always good at spending good money after bad. They're not known for efficiency or spending money smartly.
Right. I mean, look, if I was Senator Susan Collins right now, in the time where you've had the Democrat fall apart, completely in disarray, I would have absolutely moved some reservation money up and forward to get pro-Susan ads on air aggressively right now, because you've got a desert of information. Why wouldn't you be? Let's get aggressive.
And define the campaign on your terms before Democrats can organize.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to do a dramatic reading here because this Atlantic profile of Mark Kelly.
Oh, yeah. Mark Leibovich, my buddy Mark Leibovich wrote this one.
He did. And Mark does terrific work. He's been on the show before. But this profile of Mark Kelly and his wife, Gabby Giffords, we all remember Gabby Giffords as a member of Congress doing an outreach event in Tucson, shot, nearly killed. But here's an anecdote, unlike any anecdote I've ever read in any political profile in my entire career, which is more than 40 years. Way too long. I agree. Here, listen to this. After she was shot, doctors performed an emergency craniectomy on Giffords, removing a large portion of her skull to reduce pressure on her swelling brain. Kelly asked the doctor what would happen to the original chunk of the bone. It will go in the incinerator, the doctor told him. And I was like, Gabby's in a coma right now. I think she might want it. That's what Mark Kelly said. It goes on. Listen to me, ladies and gentlemen. We stuck it in the freezer, Kelly told me, in a Tupperware container. They still have it too. Next to the turkey, Kelly said. I thought this might be a joke, but it was not, Mark Leibovich writes. Kelly seemed to notice me looking perhaps slightly taken aback. Slightly? It's not in the freezer we use every day, he clarified. It's a separate freezer. What?
The special skull freezer.
You what? Got with the, it's not with the ice cream. Everyone,
what? Down, yes. Are you like, when I say, ladies and gentlemen, I've never come across an anecdote like that in 40 years of reading.
That's a spouse looking out for his partner, knowing what she would have wanted. Like, I'm not going to get rid of your skull. You might want to keep this.
Do you
this.
Think your wife would do that? She'd want
the, absolutely the, not. That would not be in the freezer or near the popsicles.
Think my husband
are you kidding
would,
me?
I think my husband would want it. And my only similar thing is when I grew up riding horses, I had a horse that had bone chip removal surgery, and they asked me if I wanted to keep the bone chips. And I was like, you know what? No, thank you so much, but I appreciate the offer.
I mean, Connor would want to keep your skull and study it for science, perhaps.
Study's not worth it.
So let's just say when this week began, I was not expecting to be discussing here at the tavern bone chips or skull fragments.
That's why we have alcohol.
I mean,
in political profiles. Quickly, because we haven't gotten to this yet, and it's interesting. There's an August 11th primary in Wisconsin for governor on the Democratic side, and has been completely upended in the last week. So the lieutenant governor, Sarah Rodriguez,
in, front runner.
Looking good, front runner, massive campaign finance scandal that she uncovers or is uncovered underneath her nose, and she drops out. Milwaukee County executive, these are not names you're familiar with, but they matter. David Crowley jumps back in, immediately gets the endorsement of Tony Evers, the sitting governor, outgoing out governor, and the establishment. But State Representative Francesca Hung, the progressive, still looks like she has the inside track. Hurt?
Yeah, what you're seeing here is what I call the Graham Plattner effect. All of a sudden, Democrats in a lot of different places, Michigan, Wisconsin, are going, uh-oh, these far-left candidates may not cut it outside of New York City or California. And if we allow them to take these nominations in places like Michigan, in places like Wisconsin, we will lose those seats. We will not be gaining ground. We'll be losing ground. And then one of the most favorable electoral environments you could possibly ask for, Democrats are close to snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. So they're trying to run more establishment candidates. I know establishment's a bad word, but trying to run
candidates. They've got a very short window to try to do that. Aaron?
Well, also, when you look at Wisconsin, Crowley coming back into this race between Mandela Barnes here, he's almost a killjoy here because he's taking away the vote, splitting that, which is going to make Hong stronger in the long run, not weaker. And Wisconsin is a purple state, but it has a progressive base and has for decades. You can go back to Scott Walker, Act 10, taking over the Capitol in 2011 people moved in for months in Wisconsin. So this is a purple state at its core. I've done multiple cycles there. I think Hong right now is still the favorite to win.
Yeah. You look at why Hillary lost in part in Wisconsin in 2016. It's because Bernie Sanders voters stayed home.
They did. Aaron McGuire, Kurt Bardella, enjoy the tavern. You're always welcome. Cheers. Happy Tuesday, everyone. This is The Takeout, relentlessly curious, reliably civil, occasionally clever.
Criminal Minds Evolution is back on Paramount Plus.
Do you think it's possible to discern some hidden patterns shared by all serial killers?
With a new killer each week.
I see those wheels turning.
When a copycat killer emerges, the BAU will form a dark alliance with a familiar foe.
Elias, would you help us?
This season, evil is contagious.
Once it starts, it can't be stopped.
Criminal Minds Evolution. New season now streaming on Paramount+.